I'm Josh Cooperman, and this is Convo by Design, with a conversation featuring architect Wade Wiseman. Wiseman is the principal and founder of Wade Wiseman Architecture. The firm has studios in Santa Barbara, Nashville, Milwaukee, Chicago, and Pittsburgh. Wade is a really interesting guy. You've heard me say that before, but I love talking to architects, designers, set decorators, but architects in particular have that balance between the creative side and the scientific side. And Wiseman is kind of a mad scientist. He has a very eclectic sense of space, and he balances that against historic influences to create really amazing environments. The following conversation is about craftsmanship, innovation, and application of time-tested techniques. Wade talks about the influence of past masters and incorporating his own ideas to come up with a cohesive yet vibrant and interesting style that is constantly changing. If you haven't already guessed, this was fun, challenging, and a very detailed conversation that was just enjoyable, and I hope you like it as much as I did. This is architect Wade Wiseman. If you enjoyed the conversation, and I hope that you do, please give us a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps new listeners find the show, and it's greatly appreciated. Thanks. Convo by Design is presented by Snyder Diamond, always first with what's next in the kitchen and bath. Snyder Diamond is a family-owned and operated company that serves the Southern California design and architecture community, as well as discriminating homeowners, through remarkable customer service and a curated offering of kitchen and bath appliances, fixtures, and finishes. The products at Snyder Diamond include the industry's best, like the full line of Miele appliances. Miele, a family-owned and operated company offering industry-leading products since 1899. This includes a full line of refrigerators, ovens, steamers, cooktops, wine units, coffee machines, dishwashers, ventilation hoods, washers, and dryers. All of these products are made using the highest standards in manufacturing and industry-leading technology to provide a superior class of appliance. Form, function, and future. That's Miele. Pair that with the standard bearer when it comes to customer service, and Snyder Diamond delivers dreamy kitchens that exceed expectations. If that's not enough, right now, and for a very limited time, Miele is offering some amazing and very generous rebates and offers. For details on these and to see the full line of Miele products, visit any of the 3 Southern California Snyder Diamond locations or visit online at snyderdiamond.com. You didn't meet, but you were here at the Pacific Design Center for West Week, and you were doing a panel on international influence, international design. Is that what it was?
It was the influence of travel on design.
Okay. In a nutshell, I love this question because I love to travel, and almost all architects and designers, it's really weird. It's not weird. One of the things that seems to be a constant is travel is a big pastime. Do you like to travel?
I love to travel. Yeah. And there's a reason for it. I mean, I think the cultures and the things that you see when you're traveling just renew your sort of inner spirit. Especially when you're creative. Creatives need to be fed all the time. And we get fed through various methods of nourishment. But one of them that is so fertile is travel. It's just great. It's a perfect way to do it.
International travel is great. But what's interesting about you and your firm is you have, what, 5 offices around the country?
We do, yes.
And the major offices are where?
So the major studios are in Milwaukee, which is where I'm from, my hometown, and Chicago. And then we have secondary offices in Pittsburgh, Nashville, and Santa Barbara.
Really interesting. How did you choose those locations?
They were sort of chosen for me through opportunities, really. The opportunity in Nashville came about through a relationship that I had in the equestrian world. And was introduced to a client that was centered in Nashville and had a farm there and asked me to do a master plan for the farm. And the work led to another project to do their residence in one of the neighborhoods of Nashville. Then I met my now partner, who is also was living in Nashville. And so now we decided to keep Nashville as a part of our life and open an office there. And it's a vibrant place right now. There's a lot of interesting development that's taking place with the entertainment industry and the music industry. You have a sort of little darling in the Middle South that has got a great vibe.
It does have a great vibe. It's very Memphis. It's very Austin-like.
Yeah.
From an architecture perspective, what is the architectural vibe there? What is the acceptance level? What is the what can you do there? What can you get away with? What do you want to get away with? What do you want? Sometimes people will go into a new market and think, oh, I'm influenced by Santa Barbara, I'm influenced by Chicago, I'm influenced by LA, I'm influenced by, you know, Pennsylvania. Yeah. Here's what I'm going to do here. Is that the approach, or is the approach, you know, work with the clients, whatever they want, we'll make it happen?
I think every designer has a different way of responding to their environment. My way of looking at the environment, you know, sort of brings in a few ingredients. I look to see what traditionally has been the influences on design in that location. And that's brought about by looking at historic structures, you know, from, you know, public buildings and civic structures to, you know, old farms, indigenous buildings, to the residential neighborhoods that, you know, came about, you know, at the turn of the last century. And you start to see a pattern of craftsmanship and materials that are being used. And there's a palette that begins to emerge. You know, Nashville's built on a dome of rock, and the limestone there has a beautiful sort of rich gray color to it. Very warm, neutral, but not the same kind of limestone that you would find in like Indiana or in the upper Midwest, which is a very light colored limestone. And then you have, you know, brickworks that are making brick from the local clay, and that has another sort of rich color to it. And you start to see these ingredients in a lot of the buildings, and the architects and the builders had, you know, built a sort of a framework of buildings that, you know, have this backdrop of palette to it and this color and this scale.
So that's really interesting. All right. So I spent a lot of time in Texas. And okay. What's really interesting about Texas is same thing, how you describe it. First of all, you've got this Austin limestone, which is very light in color, but you see it kind of emanating out from Austin, you know, into surrounding areas. But it's interesting too, because all over Texas, because it was at one point millions of years ago underwater. So they have that really deep, rich clay that is phenomenal for brick making, which is great. But it's also, you drive down every single street and they're all brick.
Yeah.
Everything's brick. How do you break away from that?
You know, I think you start looking at the way those materials can work together. And then you look for ways to contrast those materials with something new so that both of the materials are heightened a little bit. You know, I love metal roofs, and you see these great old tin roofs everywhere. And then years ago, they would rust, so they would, you know, paint them and coat them. And so you see this incredible sort of indigenous red color, this really great sort of red color. And it seems to contrast perfectly with the trees and the foliage around it and the brick. And so now you have this new material that's been sort of added, but even simply painting the brick. So the texture is there, but now you have this sort of relief of that rich sort of brick color in more of a subtle pattern and a more neutral color, which I think also is a great contrast.
Well, it's interesting too, because I really want your opinion on this. In you bring up a couple other really interesting points, but we're just diving way down the rabbit hole here. But like in Memphis, you'll have, and you're talking about seeing the metal roofs. Well, there's a reason why they go with metal roofs anywhere. If you're anywhere near Tornado Alley and you're getting baseball size hail coming down, it's going through a regular roof. But you know what? So metal roofs are prevalent through that whole area. That being said, when you come from certain areas, and this is what I find fascinating. So with the markets where you have studios, do you find yourself intentionally trying to pull away Santa Barbara, for example. Santa Barbara has a look.
Right.
It's a look. Yeah. Do you find yourself trying to pull away? Can you pull away? Do you even want to pull away because it's so widely accepted? Or do you just sort of go with the flow and then add your own elements when and where you can?
You know, if you look at the areas that we're working in, there is going to be some cross-pollination between some of the indigenous buildings that we see in one location to another. Santa Barbara has a really rich tradition of sort of Spanish colonial style. And it's very indigenous there, right? So, but a lot of it sort of started with, you know, full masonry adobe buildings because they use the materials from the land, but it's not very good with earthquakes. So, you know, essentially what's adapted now is an adapted style. So the style's there, but it's on a wood-framed, you know, structure so that it has this pliability that can sort of shake and handle, you know, the earthquakes that come from time to time. And so you'll end up with cracks in the stucco, but structurally it's, you know, not going to crumble and kill somebody. So you see the way that architectural styles have been adopted by modern technologies the more we understand. And so it's really interesting to sort of see, you know, how architects take a style and, you know, adapt it, you know, to the structural limitations that we have in an area. But the interesting thing for me is that the composition of the elevations and massing of those buildings are very casual. They don't always align openings in a formal way. They shift things from left to right. They create intentional asymmetries and a casual sort of facade study, which in my opinion is something that, you know, is universal. It's taking those ideas and abstracting how we compose an elevation. And that teaches me how to start thinking about delineating program in a building and changing the facade. And that can be adapted anywhere. That is a lesson that we can use anywhere. We don't necessarily have to, you know, put on elliptical topped openings or arches, but that sort of richness of that graphic design exercise that some of these architects had done so masterfully are lessons that we get to share in our other locations, in our other, you know, areas of the country that we're working. But we can do that with indigenous materials in those locations, but we are cross-pollinating some of the design ideas.
So speaking of other areas where you have studios, so let's talk about Pennsylvania for a minute. We were talking about Frank Lloyd Wright a little earlier. Many people aren't really totally aware that Frank Lloyd Wright, there's a distinct footprint there. You know, yeah. You've got Falling Water, of course.
Right.
But, you know, right nearby, you've got, what is it, Knob Hill? I'll think of it.
Okay.
But there's that one. There's also a series, probably three or four of his Usonian
right.
homes outside of there.
Absolutely.
Does Pennsylvania have a, does it have a feel? Does it have a style?
It does. Again, you know, there's another whole sort of treasure chest of materials that come from the Appalachian Mountains and from the river valleys where you have all this sort of amazing sort of clay silting, and so you have great brick buildings. You also had the steel industry, and so the steel industry also created these incredible opportunities to do this really expressive structure. So when you look at our offices in Pittsburgh, and when you look around Pittsburgh, there's these incredible steel bridges and structures all around because steel factories were there. And so you have this sort of other really interesting turn of the century industrial age sort of influence on top of that, which is a really powerful sort of really powerful structural purity that comes onto the architecture there. And so you see this really interesting integration. So you see the stone, you see the brick, but now you have steel, and you see the rivets, and you see the connections, and you see this, you know, very sort of like big-shouldered architecture that sort of, you know, layered on top of it all. And that's exciting for me because I love that kind of utilitarian architecture aesthetic.
Well, and it's interesting too because Pennsylvania, Pittsburgh in particular, home of the Wabash Railway Station, only lasted, what, 50 years?
Right.
And then they sort of, the Boart structure, they decided, you know what, we're changing direction, we're going, and it's very LA-like in the impermanence of the style, but also it's adventurous on their part from an architectural standpoint. And I don't think a lot of people feel that way or really recognize that about the that particular area. And you mentioned Big Shoulders, so I'll take you over to Chicago now.
Right.
From a Midwest perspective, you know, I think some of our greatest architecture in the States has come out of the Midwest.
Right.
So how's that for a market? What do you think of that? And by the way, I'm taking you in all these different areas because it's not often that I get a chance to talk to someone who has studios in sort of that. That's a vast range. That's a big range, right?
Yeah,
you're going from
right.
Santa Barbara with that Spanish colonial to the Midwest to, so you've got a lot of different perspectives. What do you think about Chicago from an architecture standpoint?
Chicago historically is an unbelievable treasure trove of, and I've used this expression before, but there are some absolutely incredible architectural buildings that are, they pushed their limits at the time. I mean, it was sort of the birthplace of modern architecture. So, you know, steel was used after the Chicago fire and really sort of developed this sort of ability to, you know, shed the limitations of masonry architecture and or wood architecture or something that was not very good as far as durability in a fire, iron. You know, iron shatters and when it gets, you know, to a certain temperature. And so, you know, you saw this amazing ability to start reaching towards the sky with steel. And so Chicago's architecture and the history of the Chicago architecture has an amazing influence on the city itself. And really was a pretty awe-inspiring urban place when you think about what happened post the Chicago fire around the turn of the century. You know, Chicago really did sort of set the pace architecturally all the way up until pretty much the end of the 1970s, 1980s, when you know you had the you know the Sears Tower was the tallest building in the world, and you know since then I think you know there have been other cities that have sort of surpassed Chicago as an urban place, but what's left there is remarkable, and it's an inspiration to every designer that works there. There's also a really interesting thing that's happening in a lot of places, which is, you know, when the automobile came about in the 1940s and 50s, you know, there was this suburban sprawl. And there were traditional neighborhoods in the city that surrounded the downtown areas that kind of went blighted, right? So, you know, you ended up with these neighborhoods that urban renewal was, you know, essentially trying to, you know, sort of banish. But the ones that survived are this rich tapestry of amazing buildings that were close and they were streetcar oriented, so they were much more urban, and there's a density in those neighborhoods that is really wonderful, you know, alley oriented, you know, you know, buildings that allowed for as much storefront as possible rather than the driveways and things that accommodated the car. And so now those areas you see all across the nation are, you know, being gentrified. You know, people are back in those neighborhoods. You know, buildings that were lost are being infilled. And there's this wonderful sort of embrace of urban places again that creates this richness. And all that architecture is now essentially, you know, being rehabbed, not necessarily being lost as much, but, you know, sort of reused, you know, freshened up and brought into a more modern way of thinking. And I love that there's this juxtaposition of these modern buildings right next to these, you know, historic edifices, which is really a rich, wonderful environment to be in.
It really is. And forgive me, because I only know, I'm forgetting parts of this story, but maybe you'll know this. There's a new boutique hotel that's just going up across the street from Wrigley.
from Wrigley. I'm not familiar
okay.
with it.
All right. Yeah, and I'm not putting you on the spot. It's a boutique hotel. It's very small. I will. I'll go back. And in the beginning, when I record the intro for this conversation, I'll look it up and I'll mention it. But basically, the concept is, for the hotel, is it's being reimagined after the architect who designed Wrigley.
Wow.
And by the way, he's also the architect that designed the original Wrigley Field out here in L.A.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And
wow.
But I think it's interesting that Chicago has it's a modern spot, and that they're naming a hotel, a boutique hotel, after an architect. I think that's kind of cool.
I think that's really cool.
Yeah.
It's about time.
Yeah. And I'll send you the name of it. It's a small place, but it's opening this year. So I don't know that it's open yet, but it's a really cool concept.
And that's exactly what I'm talking about. You know, you're finding this, you know, and some of these neighborhoods have remarkable buildings that have been left. You know, institutional buildings that were, you know, beautiful, amazing pieces of architecture, and the craftsmanship on these were, you know, done at a time where there was this incredible pride. And so when somebody was going to, you know, leave something behind, you know, they did it architecturally. And I love that. A lot of that's been lost because we now think of buildings as being very disposable. Unfortunately, that leads to cheaper building materials, less craftsmanship. The good thing is that those buildings that do have that kind of craftsmanship, they're actually more cherished now. They become a little bit more precious.
What's your take on that? Because I had a conversation recently with Ken Bernstein, who is with the City Planning Office of Architectural Preservation.
Okay.
And we're talking about HPOZs, the historical preservation zones, right? And there's, I believe, 37, 38 of them around Los Angeles now. And the conversation really revolved around, you know, LA has this reputation for not supporting grand architecture.
Hmm.
And while it's true that we've taken down our fair share of remarkable structures, it's also with architecture. You know, you have architects who are you're creative. You know, you are a creative. You're half scientist, half mathematician. You know, so it's or half mathematician, half creative, half artist. Right? So
10% code official.
Yeah. So so when you create something, you know, maybe you're looking at it from a standpoint of creating a legacy. At the same time, it's got to stand the test of time, and not all structures do that. Recently, one of the LA area Googies lost its protections.
Hmm.
So, you know, that'll be going down. Is that a bad thing? I don't know. Maybe if you love Googie architecture, then you're torn up about it. But the way that the city is changing, it doesn't architecture have a responsibility to keep up with the standards of the city in which it resides?
That's a really great question, and it's obviously a controversial topic. And I think there are, not every old building deserves to be there just because it's old. You know, sometimes structures just outlive their useful life, and they're hard to adapt to. We do have much more sort of conscientious codes that take into account, you know, handicap accessibility, and take into account the ability for people that have physical limitations to be able to adapt to a structure and actually thrive in the built environment. And that's a good thing. I think it's a really good thing. Culturally, there are periods of time historically that we responded, the design world responded in a way that creates some legacy solutions that are worth keeping, because I think they're worth looking at that moment in time, the iconography around what happened at that period of time, you know, around us, does leave a social mark, and there are places for us to retain that. Then you got to balance that with the, you know, the value of real estate and where, you know, American, you know, fiscal ingenuity is looking for opportunities. And sometimes, unfortunately, there might be places where some of this architecture occurred that didn't have the same land value. that you have now. And, you know, you have to kind of balance and look and say, you know, what's the natural evolution of things? Do we just, you know, put our arms around it, put a rope around it and say it has to stay there forever? Or do we say, you know, that was a moment in time? I don't know, but it'll always be a controversial subject.
At the same time, I think that sometimes there is a lack of forethought that goes into it. And certainly in a city this big, you know, trying to centralize city planning is impossible,
right?
Especially because LA, excuse me, LA is not one city. LA is many cities, more like New York with the boroughs. We have 50 different cities here. I mean, there, right. This is LA is not one place. So you'll have properties like, you know, things that have been torn down. A lot of people will talk about the Brown Derby.
Right.
Okay. You know what? It was a goofy structure. It was a building that was shaped to look like a hat. Okay. It's cool. I get it. But more kitsch than function. Right.
Right.
So then you've got another LA landmark like a Randy's Donuts.
Mm-hmm.
It's still around. So are about four other of those donut top buildings. And guess what? They're tiny and they're in places where you're not going to build anything else more than likely. So they probably will be there forever.
Right.
You have places here like the Apple Pan. I don't know if are you familiar with the Apple Pan?
Not familiar with that.
Okay. It's a restaurant.
No.
It's a restaurant on Pico across from the mall, which by the way, the mall isn't going to make it. The mall's going down, but the Apple Pan used to be a house. It's small. It's tiny. It is. You walk in. It's an old house with a U-shaped counter. There are no tables. U-shaped counter. You walk in anytime. It's three deep because the burgers are phenomenal.
Right.
It's amazing. The architecture is not spectacular, but it's a landmark. It's a cultural landmark. And then you have things like the Ambassador Hotel.
Right.
So the Ambassador Hotel, that went down. Or it was converted into a school. Now, with the housing crisis that we have here in the city, that was a major hotel.
Yeah,
that could have easily been converted into residential or even multi-use, but it wasn't thought of that way.
Right.
So I don't know. Where's the balance?
There are these creative developers that do find opportunities where the mainstream developer does not see value or can't make the numbers work. But I'm working with a couple of people that I think are really inventive. They're finding ways to use historic tax credits to their advantage, and they're able to start shifting the mathematical formulas to make projects like that much more viable. And there is as development kind of comes to a frenzy right now, we have a huge expansion going on in our economy, and it seems like there are lots of different developers out there. And it's interesting because each one of those developers now are beginning to start looking at niche markets differently. They're beginning to look at buildings differently, and they're looking for opportunities that may not have existed in the mainstream sort of push of development that, you know, you may have found with, you know, individuals that made it famous to be a developer. Our president is a developer, first and foremost. And, you know, they are now shifting their attention to look for diamonds in the rough, so to speak. So although at that moment it may not have seemed feasible and we lost something really great, I think today we're finding a whole new breed of development people that are coming in looking at things a little bit differently.
And that being said, from your perspective, when you look at your practice, when you look at your studios and you look at what you're working on, what are you working on now? And how do you imagine that your business as an architect, how do you imagine that this is going to change in the next 10 years?
Wow, that's a lot to think of. Well, I think our business has adapted quite a bit. And I've always thought, although my practice has been, you know, mostly private residences, I've always thought of those buildings as needing to be as dignified as possible. And being representative of being a good citizen, so to speak. And although a building is a building, it has the ability to sit in a community with a certain amount of dignity, meaning it doesn't have to, you know, pull a lot of attention to itself. And in a quiet, anonymous way, it can be a really model citizen, so to speak, and hold its place as being a good building, meaning it creates inspiration and it heightens the activity that takes place inside of it. It embraces its neighbors, it sits in its context well, and it ages gracefully. It has dignified materials that stand the test of time. And there was an investment by the owner to let it be a dignified building. So I think a building can be a good citizen. It doesn't always have to be, you know, this, you know, sort of Starkitect kind of inspired piece of art in order to be a good building. Our practice has always looked at those opportunities in a larger context. Because we looked at the community, because we look at the region, and we look at the critical regionalist, you know, sort of influences on design, I think we make really good buildings. And people that we've worked with have said, wow, that's a really great building. I love living in it. I bet my office could use an environment like that. I bet the hotel down the street could use an environment like that, or the restaurant down the street could have a feeling like that. It doesn't have to be the latest, greatest, hot space to be. It can just be a really good, dignified, comfortable place that I go to five nights a week, and then I can go to the, you know, sort of hot place one night a week. And then that'll change, you know, a year later, it's some other new hot place. But because I look at architecture that way, I think of it way beyond my life expectancy and way beyond what, you know, its original purpose might be and how it might be adapted. It has allowed our practice to grow. We've now been asked to look at other buildings that now have more sort of stature in the civic environment that they're in, but the practices are the same. You know, how does it relate to the neighborhood? How does it become a good citizen? How does it stand the test of time? How does it readapt itself? And how does it age gracefully? You know, how does it become a good citizen?
Any projects that you're working on right now that you're really excited about?
Everyone.
Okay.
Every project I'm excited about. We have a variety of really interesting projects. Right now, we've been working on a farmhouse for a biodynamic farm that has a pretty tremendous cause, and it's up in Moore Park, so it's just outside of LA. It is a beautiful environment where the purpose has the purpose of the property, you know, literally has a mission statement, and it talks about sustainable farming practices. The interconnectedness of creating really wholesome, nutritious food that's kind to the environment, and it nurtures, which is a pretty interesting thing. Given the commonplace of food and restaurants, the simple, most essential ingredients, being nutritious, is a really great cause. It goes back to the absolute basics. And so creating an environment, a domestic environment that, you know, sort of becomes the backdrop for the people who run and own this farm, as a place of gathering, as a place of being able to share those incredible ingredients with creative chefs from all over the country, as a place to come and gather and bring, you know, their most essential sort of people around them to celebrate there and to test the water, so to speak, is a really interesting cause. And so we have this great project going on there that'll be finished in about a year. And it's really all about, you know, the gathering spaces being outside, and celebrating the incredible weather that you have here and being more closely connected to the farm around it. And then the spaces inside are really the spaces of refuge. You know, they're the places that you, you know, retire to, that you shelter yourself from when the weather is extreme or there's a fire nearby and embers are flying. It's, you know, it's a place to harness yourself and let the sort of environment harshness pass you by, and then you can gather again once again outside and be part of the landscape. I'm working on a hotel community. It's in the preliminary stages where essentially we're sort of almost developing a small hill town outside of the city downtown area of Nashville. And it's a pretty extraordinary opportunity. It mixes places of dwelling with places of work. There's a huge wellness component to it. So again, this sort of ingredient of sort of healthy living, is sort of woven into the whole thing. But then it's also a place of celebration and gathering. So it does have the ability to create and bring people together from all over the country to celebrate maybe a musical performance at the music venue, or a particular benchmark in someone's life that is needing a place to, you know, celebrate, along with places to live and work. And it's hopefully going to create a model for us to be able to recreate that in some other places in the country, which we're hoping we're going to build a brand associated with the design here, which is a really interesting, unique opportunity.
That sounds really cool. We're going to check back with you on that as that progresses, if
Perfect.
That's okay.
That'd
sounds
great.
That
yeah,
sounds really
to.
Cool. Last two questions for you, and they're the softballs, so they're the easy ones.
Okay.
What products are emerging right now that are changing the way you're doing business? And that could be planning tools. That could be utilization. But it can also be materials that you're using. What's changing the way you do business right now?
I think the methods of communication are allowing us to be able to bring together project teams that have ingredients from different locations around the country. And I think that will actually create what I would consider a more dynamic team that, you know, can ask questions based on the location that we're working in or that you live or based in. You have, the first part of any meeting is, hey, I heard it's snowing in Milwaukee. What's happening there? You know, has everybody gotten to the office? And so, and you can, you know, pair that with, you know, a time change of 2 hours in California where it's, you know, 75 degrees and sunny. And so I think that influence of where we live, it brings different topics of discussion up, and that tests the design solution. So for us, we're utilizing now communication technology that allow us to be able to share ideas together from remote locations. It allows us to be able to communicate immediately with people all over the country. Site conditions, situations that are taking place, you know, during the course of construction, that allows us to communicate with contractors and other people that are bringing in ingredients from all over. It also brings in a certain diversity, a level of craftsmanship that may be found in other places. And so we do have this ability now to utilize technology in a way that keeps our sort of design teams communicating with each other effectively from all over the country.
That's great. And the last question, the absolute softball of them all. You mentioned sort of the red steel roofs or red tin roofs, which yeah. it got me thinking about in all the markets that you have, in which you have studios, each of those cities have sort of color palettes all their own. And I'm just curious, do you have a color palette that you of preference right now?
I love color, and so I'm not afraid of color. It depends on how and what we see and the and what we're looking to attract with our color palettes. I would say right now, I still think that neutrals and cleanliness is in. I think the juxtaposition of materials against one another is something that really has been explored a lot lately in design, and there's some incredible people that are doing some really incredible things, design teams that I respect and love very much and use as inspiration. And I see them utilizing and playing with, and just like we see these sort of anonymous sort of building types that are going up all around us that almost have like a graphic design exercise to the elevations. I have my criticisms of that kind of anonymous architecture, but I also see that there are some people that do it really beautifully. And I love that juxtaposition. I think it's very interesting. I think that sometimes it can be a little much, but I also very much embrace the way I'm seeing certain designers embrace it and do some really wonderful things with it too.
Very cool. Wade Wiseman, thanks for the time.
Thanks, Josh.
Convo by Design is proud to be working with Vendome Furniture. Design culture, it's the key to their success. It's what pushes them to consistently create new collections that give spaces a new dimension. They create dialogue between environment and form. Vendome pieces can transform the simplest space into one filled with glamour that is both unique and extraordinary. And isn't that what design is all about? Creating atmospheres where you can take hold of life and enjoy it to the fullest? Vendome products are simple and elegant, contemporary and exceptionally comfortable. Their crafted, modern, durable, molded resin, glass, and metal designs are unique and they beg to be enjoyed. They search the planet for the right designers that embody the Vendome spirit and work together to create remarkable pieces into an exclusively Vendome mode of expression. And if you haven't seen Vendome before, you can check them out in some of the Convo by Design videos you'll find on our YouTube channel. But you can find them in their showrooms at the D&D Building in New York, Wynwood in Miami, and the Pacific Design Center here in LA, or online at Vendome.com.